Hello, Mage fans, and welcome to Mage the podcast that works hard towards ascension so you don't have to. I'm your host, Adam Simpson. I'm joined by Terry Robinson. For some people, death is the end. For wraiths, death is the beginning of a miserable experience. But what if death was not the end or the beginning, but just hitting the reset button? We'll talk about that today on Tomes of Magic. So, Terry, do we have any announcements?
Just that, since we are talking about Mummy today, it is appropriate to say we have had two interviews talking about Mummy, the Resurrection. Not quite the same thing, but not quite different. Links to those will be in the show notes.
Well, thanks. Today we are looking at Mummy First Edition, which came out in 1992 and was written by Stephen Wick. It clocks in at 83 pages. And Terry, can you start us off with a walkthrough?
I'll be glad to. The first thing I would like to note is I think Mummy was an excuse to be like, John Cobb, this guy's going somewhere. What if we had him illustrate an entire book? And people are like, call it Wraith? And he's like, no, that's too weird. A different book involving people who aren't quite dead. And they're like, mummies? Yeah, quit digging, you hit oil. And that's how this came about. This book has big Stephen Wick just sat down and wrote the whole thing in a three-day weekend. And Rob Hatch and Andrew Greenberg just looked at it and like did the audible blink and are like, yep, that exists. My alternate title for this is Mummy, You Want Old? I'll give you old.
Yeah, there was a lot of John Cobb art in here, and I was just thinking to myself, I'll bet when they were in the planning stages for Wraith First Edition, they approached John Cobb and said, we don't want your art, we need your art for this book. If you do not agree to sign on as artist, I don't think we can make this game.
Just like on page 17, there's an angry baboon out of nowhere. Why? Because John Cobb, that's why. And then midway through, suddenly you get the art of Jas Gabriel Timbrook. And there's the artist Janet Alesio mentioned, who I don't recall seeing that name elsewhere. But like working backwards, you're like, well, it's not John Cobb. It's not Jas Gabriel Timbrook. I think I could figure out who this is. This ain't bad. That's fun. And in that introduction where we got a special thanks section that's like a mile and a half long, and then we've got the word from White Wolf Game Studio that's like, yes, we're working on Werewolf. Stop asking. I like the idea that like your books are coming out fast enough and with sufficient fury that you can do like a very slow postcard system with like your readers to tell them how things are going. That was all just a delightful breath of fresh air before we get to the introduction, which is one page. It's just one page. It goes full page art. Introduction, which is mostly white space and a single quote, and then full page art. And you're like, what is this? It tells us that mummies are quiet witnesses and view themselves as part of the cycle of creation. There isn't enough space in the introduction to say anything else. Did you have any thoughts on the intro or the first little bit of the book, Adam?
The introduction promises an introduction to the reader to the spirit world of mummies. We'll see how well that plays out. Also, mummies as a word is capitalized in this book, which I thought was an interesting choice. But yeah, on to chapter one.
Yeah, this book had big German as our first language vibes because there were just a lot of nouns in here that were capitalized. Magi was always, a lot of the vampire terms were always capitalized. And we get a chapter one opening quote that's a mute song lyric. Angel or devil, I was thirsty and you wet my lips by you too. Trip through your wire. We get intro fiction where Sahura is introduced as befriending a vampire in the 1930s who killed an artifact thief. The narrator gets a walkthrough of the house where each room is tied to a different time period. And the mummy starts out by saying, man, exposition right out the gate. The mummy is like, I've been killed 25 times. I don't know if I would use that as an opening line to show how cool I am. Because like, if you're naturally kind of immortal and you've died, you've still managed to die 25 times. I would like I'll give you like two of those as being like, you got hit by a car or like run over by a horse. But the rest of them, something happened. And I don't know if I necessarily view that as you being great at living if you've died 25 times. We find out that after a mummy dies, their Ba wanders the spirit world, the Ka is the ghost that guards their body in the material world, and they were given the gift of enduring life because he was such a great painter. And Sahura talks about a friend of his from Constantinople that's a vampire, and he's like, so how are the vampires doing? Which is like me going, so Adam, how is all of Texas doing? And being like, oh, I didn't know I was responsible for keeping track of all of Texas. I like how out the gate the mummy is like, I'm not the weird one. You're the weird one. Scion of the curse of Cain. I'm like, he's kind of got him there. And we know that there are 43 mummies very specifically in total. And we get like six of them in the book. So it should be like there are 37 unnamed mummies. And the rest of them are kind of accounted for. It just leads into character generation. We get a rough outline since mummies are each unique and have their own path. And like the author is like, yeah, this is just kind of a general rule. I can't really stop you, which technically true. It's weird to just see in the character creation rule being like, ah, do what you want. It's a game about mummies, which not wrong. We get a list of opening questions like, who were you? What have you become? How do you define yourself? And what did you do to become a mummy? Nature and demeanor are listed as optional. Take that, getting willpower back. We also get asked for our current name, your known by name, your first life name, and a true name. We got names out the wazoo. There's a 3,500 year window where you could have been born, basically between 3,500 BCE and 1 BC. And then there was a random mummy created in 855 by some people who were able to create the spell of life again. Your apparent age is whatever you were when you died, and you're like, oh, I forgot what the ancient world is like. This is why all these mummies look so young, where it's like one of those things where it's the air was clean, the water was untainted, and if you were lucky, you could live to the ripe old age of childbirth. You pick a job, that's what you did in your first life, and that's what your mummy friends know you by. Imagine spending 5,000 years being judged for the fact that you were like a mediocre sorghum farmer. And you're like, you realize I invented the microchip and two-point perspective. And like my alter ego is Leonardo da Vinci. And people are like, can't hear you over the fact that you're still a sorghum farmer. So talk about not being able to outlive your origin. The job that you had kind of gives you a whole bunch of stats. It also informs how other mummies think about you because society was highly stratified. It determines how much magic juice you start with. We then get a well-written description of the attributes. One of my favorite is the one for intelligence. And intelligence isn't so much described as smarts, but memory. And it says, stop reading for a minute and try to think of your teacher and all your friends from third grade. Any luck? How's your memory? Now imagine that you've been alive for a long time and third grade was 3,000 years ago. How's your memory now? So it's kind of like this apologetics for mummies being like, they're allowed to forget stuff. I like that your ba, kind of your starting life essence, is just a D10 roll and randomness. You get a bunch of ability points instead of 13, 9, 7. You get 20, 15, 10. It's like you've been around for a while. You've had an opportunity to develop secondary skills. And we get a bunch of them. We get animal empathy, trick, writing, construction, scribing, which at 5 dots it says you have restored the glory of penmanship. Nice. And then we get thanatology, which at 5 dots says knows the secrets with 2 question marks. So even early on in 1E, we were not always sure how copy editing worked. We find out that Egyptian magic is different than Hermetic magic, which is different from Tremere magic. We get a crash course in the types of magic. We get alchemy, which is true knowledge of manufacturing potions and ointments. Amulets, which is imprisoning magic in physical objects. Celestial, which is the power to interpret the skies and to control weather and phenomenon controlled by the stars. We get figurines. Who doesn't want figurines? I love action figures. And it allows you to generate allies and servants. Hakau, the art of true names, and necromancy, which is dark magic, but also contains the rituals that save preserve the dead. We find out again about the 9 parts of the soul, but we really only care about 3. We have the ba, which is kind of your life force, the ka, which is the part that looks over your body after you die, and sekhem, which is a different kind of life force or life energy and is where magic comes from, and it can't go above 99, like you're playing an old Nintendo game. It just kind of stops there. We get a bunch of backgrounds, status, how well regarded you are among other mummies, in that there are 43 of you. You kind of all are up in each other's business, especially as you go about your life. We get supernatural as a background. You can have a magus, vampire, lupine, ghost, or fairy. Bane mummies can have demons, which has me curious about what's a Bane mummy. And it's like, oh, you know the guy. Also, you have a way of maintaining contact. So I love the fact that we have supernatural pen pal listed as something that you can spend character creation points on. And then the part that really blew my mind, virtues. So in vampire, you apparently have conscious self-control and courage. I play mage. Mages have no virtues, which I think is the most appropriate choice in the world of darkness. I don't need morals. I have magic. Yep. Yep, you do. But in addition to that, mummies can have honor, love, and truth. And I'm like, oh, that's interesting. They have alternatives. And then you get to the characters later and you're like, no, you have all six. And I'm like, I have no concept of when I will roll this, and I hope I never find out. Health is also free form. You can kind of just buy up additional ones, and you get 30 freebie points to, do mummy stuff with. So again, character creation, right out the gate, we have a screaming baboon on page 17. We have farming as a recommended skill. We get secondaries. You can be great at penmanship. I don't know about you, Adam, but I'm already like shaking with ideas for my mummy campaign. What did you think of chapter one?
In the fiction that started off this chapter, you mentioned how the vampire is getting to know the mummy, sees his house. Every room in the house is decorated with pictures on the wall and furniture from completely different eras and parts of the world. And that, I think, was really interesting for me. Each room in the house represents like a snapshot from somewhere in the world back in history. And I was thinking, that would probably be a great place for the mummy to go and sit down and like remember things from one particular life in the past. Plus, that is one hell of a conversation piece.
Yeah.
Why, I like your Louis the 14th room. I know. It was his father. I will show you a few things that will set that straight for you. The fiction hints that mummies share only necessary information with each other. Apparently, even though these 43 mummies have known each other for millennia, there's a lot they don't share with each other. Mummies have occupations, but they don't divide up into factions. There's just not enough of them. Which, for me, as a mage fan, that's always interesting because how large a group is going to support how many subgroups can be inside of it. In Revised Edition, there were a whole lot of different subgroups, and so that sort of hints that, well, there must be a lot of mages. So if you have 43 mummies worldwide, the stratification of their society before they became mummies has an effect on their relationships, but it does not push them into different groups. They are one group of mummies. Some of them are less sociable than others, but still, I thought that was very interesting. Why do we get a section explaining what the 9 attributes are? This book says, hey, use another World of Darkness rulebook to inform this. We're not going to give you all the natures and demeanors. Thank you. But we are going to explain every last attribute because the rulebook already did that and it's just fun to do it again. Okay, unnecessary. We get into skills now. When I think of mummies, I think the awareness and cosmology skills, which were created for Mage the Ascension, I think those would apply to mummies just fine. I have no problem as a storyteller allowing those two skills to mummy player characters. When it comes to the secondary skills recommended in this book, animal empathy is fine for those who are interested. Trick really should roll up into subterfuge. Writing should roll into expression. Construction, well, that depends on your game. If the players are going to be building more than one thing, okay, maybe that's worth talking about. Otherwise, it's just not necessary. Scribing should roll up into expression. Now, thanatology, that works. That is an ancient Egyptian slant on the knowledge of death and the rituals involved with it, and that totally works for mummies. It is not a required skill, but it is quite useful, and it certainly does have its context. The only background for mummies that has any supernatural quality is supernatural contacts. It's like, oh, I already have contacts. Yeah, but these are supernatural contacts. Oh, sorry. Okay, great. I'll put that in a separate line on my character sheet because some of my friends are not supernatural. Yeah, I don't know. Is that really necessary? I'm looking forward to the Mummy 2nd Edition to take another look at that. And yes, as Terry said, the virtues that finishes the chapter did get pretty confusing. I was reading it and I said, oh, there's 3 different virtues for mummies because mummies are not quite the same as vampires. I guess I get that. And so as I'm reading through chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3, it keeps saying you need to establish this value based on this vampire virtue. So it's like, oh, so why do I have to worry about the vampire virtues if I've got mummy virtues? And then we get to the, towards the end of the book and the sample characters is like, mummies have to have all 6 virtues. It's like, okay, that's so a little too virtuous for me.
It makes me wonder, like, if mage had virtues, what they would be. It would be like yeah. Dickishness, persistence, and we hate the hermetics. And you'd be like, nope, I really think he captured a lot of mage history with those 3. With those
pedanticness.
3 virtues. Yeah, pedantry.
Pedantry, sorry.
It's not just a background. It's a virtue. Mage. And appropriately, chapter two is entitled Magic, and it still throws me off sometimes to see that spelled without a K. Our two characters become friends. They fill in holes in each other's knowledge. Sahura knows magic and can command ghostly servants called Ushabtis. The ritual to create new mummies, the spell of life, was lost around the birth of Christ after the last of the cult was destroyed. The little figurines and servants that were created by the Egyptians are all around the world, but they take magic to activate. Quest! You get to call back to a time of great magic. We get to write a letter to Tachim M. Ankh, who replies in a dream, which makes me feel like mummies have a kind of very slow texting that they do, just kind of meddling with each other's dreams slowly over time. I don't know if we actually got a magic that let you influence someone else's dreams, but I'm fine with that. Mummies have access to Egyptian magic, as I indicated. It's something where you could just kind of make up new stuff. They're like, yeah, we lost a lot of the references and we were not really sure how many of the texts work. So have fun. The listings are not complete. The way the spells work is you have a difficulty number and an effect level, and you roll your magic stat against the difficulty number, and then you take the number of successes you have, multiply it by the difficulty number, and if it's greater than the effect level, you've succeeded. If it's less, you can pay the difference with Sekhem. Botching costs you Sekhem, and then you have to make a willpower roll, and if you botch the willpower roll, you start powering the ritual rather than simply being the funnel for the magic of the cosmos, and then you shrivel up and die. So magic is one of the fastest ways to be like, how many times have you been reborn? Now 26. Sekhem just kind of sucks up the XP. You have your magic rating, which you can raise also with XP, although it can take years of tutoring to increase it. And you can buy initial spells whose difficulty level in total is less than 10 minus your BA times your occupational magic rating, which needs to, and it needs to be under your current magic rating. From the people who brought you the weird taint system in Devil's Due, I bring you mummy magic. Sekhem is your vital life force. Below 10, you are visibly weak. Above 80, you exude power, which makes it sound like you would need some sort of like lightly blotching skin cream. Otherwise, you might have a bit of a glow about you. The eyes are the gateways to the power of your soul. You get about 10% of it back per day. After a day of meditation, though, you can roll your stamina and get that much more in percent. We also get a kind of starting it out, we get a system for stats above 5, like amulets and alchemy can allow you to make potions that increase your basic attributes. And they're pretty baller in that you can become so pretty that people have to roll stamina to resist you. Manipulation lets you change someone's nature and demeanor temporarily. Stamina 7, you have the endurance of a wolverine. I don't know what the endurance of a wolverine is, but apparently it's way bigger than a human. Strength 8, you can fold pennies in half with your fingers. And that's just a flex, almost literally, just to be there like a mummy and being like, the prince does not like you on his domain. And the mummy just has this stack of pennies that he's folding in half with his thumb and forefinger and just like flicking at these little leeches as they're telling him to leave. And you know what? I'm really here for that. Charisma 8, saying good girl to someone is as powerful as a vampire's kiss. Manipulation 7, as I said, you can change someone's nature and demeanor. Perception, you can see through obfuscate, and at 8, you can just roll perception instead of dodge, where you're like, yep, saw it coming. Wits 8, the high-level wit system is just like you can't actually do anything useful for a brief period of time, but when the effect wears off, you see that you get true insight into the nature of reality. And I'm like, oh, that seems nice. I don't know how I'd use it in a game, but that, yeah, that seems like a nice field trip to take. And intelligence 8 is just telepathy. You're like, you could just kind of stare at a guy and see into their memories. I love when game systems kind of go off the rails like that, and I am very here for it. And then we get information on the individual magical skills. Alchemy, you can create ointments and elixirs. It takes a day per level, and it sucks up the Sekhem. You can produce multiple doses. The one that really spoke to me was drink of 7 days rest. Oh God, just to be fully restored and not then have to sleep for 72 hours and everything is fine. I'm here for it. You can enhance your abilities, you can make someone love you, you get a bunch of options. Then we get amulets. These are very slow to produce, but and require someone who's using it to be familiar with amulets, and it takes a week per level of difficulty to fill. These, unlike alchemy, you can slowly fill them with Sekhem over time. It is a common way to ward off magic. The way the magic ward works here is basically the storyteller tells you, hey, this guy's warded. Do you want to spend extra Sekhem to overcome the ward? And you say, yeah. And then you have the option of how much you can spend. So it's kind of a little bit of a guessing game. So you want to have some juice in the tank just in case you need to overcome an amulet. The wards can protect you from mind control, wood, and other things. But I just like circle of protection wood being kind of a very clear thing. You can also protect particular organs because you're like, well, kidney's fine, but liver, I really want to keep that one in tip-top shape. We then get Celestial, which is done as a ritual. It's a lot of weather control and some other random stuff where it's like, you can control the weather. Also see someone's destiny. Also know when it's a good time to plant corn. I'm like, one of these is not like the other. You can also cause earthquakes. I love when earthquake is considered a weather. More predict someone's death. You get figurines. You can make your own friends. Figurines, you can activate them until you fail to use that figurine, in which case it becomes useless. Sekhem gets tied up until the figurine returns to its figurine form. So you've heard of the voodoo doll, but what about a voodoo tiny house? And I thought that was pretty cool. You could create like a little simulacrum of a place and you could modify it by doing that. And the big one they were like is like, yeah, you could burn it down by lighting your tiny house on fire. I'm like, okay, I don't know how I feel about that. Like, I don't know. If you spent like 80 hours making a Gundam just to burn it down, I don't know how I'd be with that. And also buildings are remarkably flammable. So anyway, but also useful in other forms. You can make like a little golem. You can make a little Ushabti foreman who can help boss your other Ushabtis around. Seemed pretty cute. Then we got a cow. You need someone's Ren, which is just their full birth name. So they're like, yeah, modern people are stupid. They just use their, they'd be all up in their shit using their true names all the time. And it does give out the point being like, why does that old guy want my middle name? And you're like, don't tell him. It is an art that is quick and deadly. The problem is that each spell is per true name. So if I want to boss around a particular person and then boss around a different person, I need to rebuy that spell key to that other person's true name. We learn that that is generally the case with humans, but with other entity types, true names are kind of shared. And they give the example of all hyenas share a true name. It then gives you with the examples of you could control trees, you could push away a tree, you can become a little bit like a tree, and a number of other tree-centric things. You can change your own true name so that your head wraps around a baseball bat as you're being hit by it, and that causes less damage. I'm like, that's a direction to take this in. And then finally, necromancy. It is described as noble but grisly, which is not a descriptor I anticipated running into, but here we are. You can free your ka to walk around, you can separate your ba, which is on a cord, and you can walk around with that. You can see the last few minutes of someone's life. You can free someone's kybit, which is kind of the part of them that contains all their negative spiritual energy. It gives no systems use for this, but it's like, yeah, it really makes it easier to go into the afterlife. So I just like the idea that if everyone had access to Necromancy 4 and this kybit ability, then Wraith as a game line wouldn't exist because it's like everyone's at peace. We also find out later that the spell of life is considered Necromancy 6, and it's like the spell is lost, but Horus is literally in Switzerland and has Necromancy 6. I'm just saying. And that brings us to the end of Chapter 2, Magic. What did you think?
I agree with you that two botches while casting a spell kills your character. Yeah, I would house rule that. I'm interested to see how second edition is going to handle that. It's like, hey, you made a bad roll. Oh, two bad rolls. You're out of the game. What? Wait, what? We can roll up a new character. Yeah, you know how long that takes? Yeah, you better get started.
Yeah.
So that was a bit excessive for me. It was interesting for me to read that several times this book linked Hermetic and Egyptian magic. It's not more, I mean, page 33 has it, but it's not the only place in this book where they mention that. And of course, at this time, Werewolf was about to come out. Mage was probably not in the writing phase. It was probably in the idea phase. And I think they already knew that they were going to take the Order of Hermes from Ars Magica and pull it into their World of Darkness mage game. But it really does suggest that there are links between Hermetic and Egyptian magic in here. Not much support or really rule systems behind that, but interesting to see. The category of celestial magic was interesting to me because I can see how mummies with their ancient Egyptian culture would see that as a very important kind of magic. Now, reading through the spells or effects of that category, they're not all that powerful. I mean, they can be useful in certain situations. It's not like it's weak sauce, I guess, but it really isn't as practical or as powerful as the other magical areas. And so for me, I interpreted that as an interesting carryover from ancient Egyptian culture, where basically mummies would say to mages, oh no, this is really important magic. And the mages would say, I don't know if I agree with that. It doesn't sound all that impressive to me. And the mummy's like, no, trust me. It's like way important. It's the real thing. One of the things that was fixed in second edition was all of ancient Egyptian magic is called H-E-K-A-U, which I'm not sure how to pronounce. I'm going to say Heka because it's just easier to say, but maybe it was Hekau or I couldn't really tell you. And then within all of the categories of Heka, there is one category called Heka. It's like, okay. Heka, from the ancient Egyptian, at least one Egyptologist in the early 20th century translated that as words of power. If you say the words of power, something powerful happens. Second edition changed the Heka category to Ren Heka, which is basically name words of power, which I think was kind of a good change. But in this first book, the Heka category is the cool stuff. That's the kind of magic that mages would be more ready to accept as a useful and powerful magic. Basically, you say the true name of something and you can affect that something. There's one true name for sand, and you say that word and you can start flinging sand at people or using it to do interesting things. And so I like that this category is here. I think that most players of mummy characters are going to latch on to this category, and I don't blame them. I just wish it was bigger. There aren't many effects in this category in this book. The second edition book adds some, but I think that was a category that really needed more attention. My last observation is, after reading this far in the book, I was thinking that when mummies are in the Umbra with mages, which I think could happen, I think that mummies are going to have to make some rolls or make some precautions to sort of keep their different components together in one place, because unlike mages and werewolves, mummies are a little more, I guess you could say, fragile, because they are basically built to split into pieces and reform later when proper pieces are energized. The drawback of that is they can be pushed into separating into pieces, which would probably cause them to end this life cycle and begin a new death cycle. And so I thought it would be interesting to see what kind of precautions or, you know, roles would a mummy need to make if they're traveling through the High Umbra with some mages and they're going to be less stable than those mages would be. That wraps up chapter 2. I'd like to take a look at the next chapter.
I do like the idea that a mixed group is preparing to go into the Umbra, and you see the werewolf who's shining up their mirror to step sideways. You've got the etherite that is trying to get their void ephemeralization machine up and running, and then you've got the mummy, and they're just wearing like a spandex unitard. That way all their parts stay together when they step sideways.
There you go.
Yep.
I got the amulet of keep it together. Oh, yep. Well, then you're fine.
That would be great, like if it were a phonetization of that, like keep it together or something like that. Yeah. But people say crossover games destroy the themes of the World of Darkness. Chapter 3 is entitled The Cycle, and we find out, or at least it purports to tell us, would find out what the travel in the spirit world is. And I will summarize the text as, is it like this? No. What about this? No, not that either. What about, I'm just not doing a great job with that. I feels you, buddy. It kind of compared looking at the other worlds to a spectrum, where at the high end you get the heavenly view of things, and maybe at the low end you get a hellish or Hadean view of things, and in between you've got the regular stuff. And I'm like, oh, okay, that's an interesting way of putting it. And this is, I wonder where the idea of people getting the afterlife they think they deserve comes from, which I never really liked, because it indicated that if you're neurotic, you're kind of screwed, and if you're a sociopath, you get off scot-free. And I don't know how I feel about that. If you drink the blood of a mummy, you can astrally project. That's good to know. We are told to avoid Easter Island and Stonehenge. I like the idea that that is merely travel advice and they're just tourist traps or something like that. It has nothing to do with how the other worlds look. And it kind of puts it through the lens of, there's a difference between the immortality that fairies and vampires have and what mummies have. Mummies have lost the ability to die, as opposed to fairies and vampires that have gained the ability to live forever. And it tells us about the difference between true death and physical death. Physical death is what happens when you're embraced. True death is what happens when you're burned to ash or hit through the chest with a 2x4. I really like that they specifically made that 2x4 mention in here. Like, screw stake through the heart. We're talking about a 2x4 and a lumber cannon. As Adam mentioned, their parts aren't quite as held together as much, and mummies have a looser tie between the soul and body. If you reach incapacitated, as opposed to, like, falling on dying, your spirit may wander away and be like, ah, he's toast. Better luck next time. And I just like kind of that loose tie with the notion of life. The other way that you die as a mummy is the gradual loss of Ba as you age. Physical or emotional trauma may destroy your Ba. It's like whenever you would need to roll humanity, I'm like, ah, a system I don't understand based on a system I don't understand. Excellent. I am truly prepared to run mummy. It may also drop if you would need to make a conviction roll or otherwise lose humanity. And it feels like mummies would need to have a hierarchy of sins, but I guess that multiple hierarchies hadn't been introduced in Vampire yet, so that's fine. We get the 9 parts of the soul. We get the Kot, the physical body, the Ka, the spirit double, the Ba, the portion that can reanimate your body, the Ab, which is the heart that accumulates sin, the Ku, which is the closest to the Christian notion of the soul, Sekhem, which is your power, Ren, which is your true name, Kaibit, which is your shadow self, and the Sohu, which is the everlasting soul. And I'm like, nice, that's a lot of souls. That's like the Whitman sampler platter of possible metaphysical bits, and I'm here for it. When you die, your body will undergo normal decay, and your Ka becomes the guardian spirit, which protects it, and it looks like a traditional ghost. It can't go more than 500 yards away from your body without spending, like, life juice. The Ka has energy, which is depleted as it protects the body, and it needs to spend energy to do it. And it's like, by the way, most of the time, just kind of appearing scares off people. That's reasonable. The Ka puts upper limits on what physical activities you can do. It can be dispelled if harmed, and then you need to kind of pick a way to get it back, which may be through spending experience points. Another is if people sacrifice in your honor. A botched sacrifice can confuse the spirit. I like how punitive the botched systems are. It's like, oh, well, you want nice things? Well, you don't get nice things. This is the world of darkness. The Ba, on the other hand, can travel widely and is not tied to the body, but it must recharge. And it does this by doing spirit quests such as loving an ugly person, protecting a boat, guiding another lost soul, or doing Gaia a solid. I just picture Steven being like, and then just writing a few things down. I'm like, oh, that's fine. You can store up your Ba, which helps to rebuild your body and to repair excess damage. You may forget skills between lives. This book really makes it clear that stamina and intelligence are like the power stats in this game, where it's like, if you die and come back, you can't have anything above your intelligence. Well, I guess I probably want my intelligence to be higher. And again, in this game, intelligence is much more tied to the notion of memory. Your body does not age while you are alive as your Ba slowly depletes, but your blood also tastes stale and dusty. That's the cycle. We get a bunch of information. We get the idea of that your soul kind of does these quests. They seem to be very freeform, which is fine. But I hope you like improvising, because it's like, we're going to tell you about the spirit world. Are you going to tell us about the spirit world? I just did. No, you told me you were going to tell me about the spirit world. You didn't actually tell me. Well, aren't they really the same thing? No, not at all. So what did you think of Chapter 3 of the cycle, Adam?
Chapter 3 had a number of interesting things in it. Yeah, like you said, the introduction said, we're going to tell you about the Egyptian spirit world. Well, there's this, the Boat of Ra travels around, and there's a lot of interesting things there. And you know how you think of hell with demons in it? Egyptian demons. Hey, okay, we're done now. Was it? Wait a minute. Are we done? Yeah, we're done. So that was a little interesting. One thing that was kind of interesting to me is reading through this book, they took the assumption that the Ka spirit, which is like spirit copy of the person that hangs around the body and protects it, this game assumes that the Ka has basically the personality and intelligence of the regular character. Reading through ancient Egyptian works, apparently the ancient Egyptians had this belief that the Ka wasn't very bright, because there are a lot of spells, incantations, pleas to the god, to the gods, etc., saying, please, when my Ka is protecting my body, please help my descendants to keep it properly well-fed and happy, so that it doesn't like wander around the neighborhood at night eating ox poop and drinking out of puddles, because I really don't want that. That would just be terrible. Let's please avoid that. It's like, wow, the Ka is that... is that dim-witted? So maybe it was a good call for Stephen Witt to say, yeah, I'm just going to say the Ka is smarter than that.
But not much. It does mention that it is easily confused. So, yeah.
Yeah, reading through one translation I have of the Egyptian Book of the Dead and some other books, there were a lot of Egyptian spells to do things which would be really, really boring in a role-playing game, and it's good that they just skipped those from the Hekaw section. This book came out in 1992. The Umbra was not yet stratified, and basically there was one Umbra, there was one area or layer of the Umbra, and everything you can think of was there. The dead were there, the ideas were there, the dreams were there, the spirits of the land were there. It was all there somewhere, just a matter of wandering through the mists far enough without stubbing your toe. This book had one idea that I thought was great, and that is when you are in the spirit world, when you encounter a greater spirit, if you like walk right up to it and try to walk through it, then you will enter its umbral realm, basically. The umbral realm that is associated with this spirit or is under the authority of this spirit. And that is something I don't recall seeing in any other World of Darkness book. A very interesting idea, but apparently they thought better of it and decided to go with the ideas established in Werewolf, which is fine, but I still think it's kind of interesting to encounter this a representation of Aphrodite in the High Umbra, and then you just like walk right into it, and then you walk into the realm of beauty and appearance and romantic love or something like that. I mean, you could take this in some interesting directions if you wanted to work with that idea. Another older World of Darkness concept that showed up in this book is the Jihad, and they spell it J-Y-H-A-D with a capital J. And this was an idea that started with Vampire the Masquerade. There's this large-scale struggle, a conflict between powerful old supernatural beings. And in Vampire, it was basically the elders of the vampires had this centuries-long struggle. The younger vampires heard hints of it, but they didn't really know what was going on. This book tries to expand that, and it says it's not just the elder vampires in this great millennia-spanning struggle. It's also Horus and, you know, some of the mummies, and there are other things too. We'll talk about them in later World of Darkness books. Now, this idea, of course, can be something worth talking about. The word jihad comes from the Islamic religion, where it has its own long-standing meaning. But I can understand where the World of Darkness writers were coming from, because I think it was the late 60s when the Dune science fiction novel by Frank Herbert made a lot of waves, got a lot of fans. And Frank Herbert took the word jihad in his science fiction novels. It was the Butlerian Jihad. And English-speaking science fiction fantasy fans thought, oh, okay, jihad, we can use that word that way. Nowadays, we spell jihad with J-I instead of J-Y, and we recognize it as a term belonging to the Islamic faith, and we want to be more respectful of that, so we're not using that word so often. And that kind of fits with the development of the World of Darkness, because in this book, Mummy First Edition, it states, yeah, the werewolves are involved in the jihad also, and then Werewolf the Apocalypse came out, we read through it, and no, they don't think that. The were-creatures are aware that elder vampires have some scuffle that they just can't pull themselves out of, but they really don't care about it. And Mage took the same direction. Mages have their own larger conflict that has nothing to do with elder vampires or mummies or any other supernatural group, and they keep to their own affairs. And so this capital J jihad of the World of Darkness sort of faded out. I guess that kind of works. We do want to be respectful of other cultures, so I'm not going to complain about that. But just interesting to see the development of these concepts over time. We are given interesting things for mummies to do when they are in their death cycle. But I just wanted to say that, okay, it's good for them to have things to do when they're in their death cycle, because they can enter it more easily than other sorts of player characters. But when a mummy goes into its death cycle, it's still basically taken out of play. I mean, there can be some communication with the other players in a player group, but it's making it an active participant in the continuing story, it's too hard to justify. The fact that mummies have a lot of interesting things to do during their death cycle, this is something that's probably going to come into play if you have an all-mummy player group. If you're mixing mummies in with others, then it's just not really going to factor into your game. That's it for Chapter 3. Chapter 4 is about storytelling. The continuing in-character fiction describes the mummy Sahura continuing the education of his vampire friend. It is time to hear the origin story of mummies, and that is the story of Osiris and Set. They visit the oldest mummy, who still lives in Egypt because he was there when it happened. In the distant past, Osiris became the chieftain near what is today Cairo. His younger brother Set failed to seize control of the government, and was banished from Egypt. A strange visitor from distant lands advised Osiris for a few months. When he left, Osiris was a vampire. Osiris's wife Isis was strong in magic, and we can take this as a hint that she was a mage. While Osiris is on a military campaign, Set returns to Egypt as a vampire. He turns court advisors against Osiris, who is tricked into getting inside a golden sarcophagus, which is then sealed shut. Set takes over, and Osiris's prison is either dumped in the Nile or guarded by Set's allies. Isis and Osiris's two sons, Anubis and Horus, flee to safety. Isis recovers Osiris, but before she can revive him, Set arrives. Osiris's body is torn in pieces and scattered about Egypt. Isis and Horus become prisoners of Set, who persecutes them severely. Set takes Horus's ba, basically his soul, and forces it into an eye, which Set removes from Horus's head. Isis escapes with Horus's unconscious body to hide in a farmer's home nearby. Isis and Anubis perfect the spell of life, the method of creating mummies, and perform it for Horus. They decide the only way to remove Set is to revive Osiris, even though they have little affection for the vampire he'd become. They gather Osiris's minions, and their magic restores Osiris's body. Just as he rises, Set appears again with his followers. Set and Osiris fight each other using their vampiric powers. Set is victorious, but Horus's ka spirit appears. Horus attacks Set and destroys his own eye, freeing Horus's ba spirit. This proves to be a disruption, and Horus vanishes. Set takes Horus's body along with Isis, as Osiris's remains are destroyed by fire. This story has lessons for us today. Whatever your problems may be, becoming an undead bloodsucker is not the answer. Also, if you become the ruler of a nation, watch out for your annoying brother. As for my thoughts, I really liked this retelling of the legend of Osiris and Set. I thought it was creative, interesting, and well-connected to the World of Darkness setting. Next is further history, which is known in bits and pieces by other mummies. The text tells us mummies disagree about details, which is a hint to storytellers. They may change what they like. Some of this is known, no doubt with inaccuracies, by some elders in the Camarilla. Most Camarilla vampires don't even know mummies are real. Set ruled Egypt openly for a short time before hiding behind puppet rulers. He tried to pry the secrets of the spell of life from Isis, but was frustrated. Horus's ka spirit plagued Set until he freed Isis along with Horus's body. Isis did not know when Horus would revive as a mummy and did not want immortality. She gathered people skilled in magic and created the cult of Isis. She taught the spell of life so they could assist Horus. Hundreds of years later, Horus returned and took charge of the cult of Isis. The cult attacked Set's servants and broke his hold on Egyptian politics. Horus and Set opposed each other for many years before Horus realized he needed more than mortal wizards to support him. He directed the cult to create more mummies to join the struggle. When Horus's next death cycle arrived, Set seized the opportunity to subtly manipulate the cult of Isis. He succeeded in getting them to choose candidates based on personal preference or superstitious grounds rather than merit. When Horus returned, he made the cult resume strict standards for choosing new mummies, but they overcompensated to the point of choosing only one person per century. Around 950 BC, Horus drove Set out of Egypt and destroyed those loyal to him. In foreign lands, Set created the vampire clan called the Followers of Set. Sometime near the beginning of the Common Era, Horus was in his death cycle. Set's followers killed the members of the cult of Isis, leaving one wizard who they forced to reveal the secret of their ritual. Set used his hard-won ritual on 5 men and 2 women, but it went wrong. Errors given by the last of Horus's wizards, together with Set's changes to bind the new mummies to his will, resulted in the Bane mummies. They were so twisted, both physically and mentally, that Set made no more. In the year 132, Horus resurrected and moved his base of operations to what is today Switzerland. It wasn't a land of banking or luxury in those days, but it did have a central location in the larger known world of that time, and its geography lended itself well to people who wanted to remain hidden. Lots of mountains and deep valleys. Around this time, Set retreated to hibernation, where he continued to direct his followers. To this day, Horus and Set oppose each other, both in our world and the spirit world. The next section gives us the origins of the children of Osiris. A vampire loyal to Osiris named Ketamon survived the final fight with Set. He fled to India and sought peace rather than power. He gathered other vampires who shared his views and founded the bloodline called the Children of Osiris. A bloodline is a smaller group of vampires with less influence than the vampire clans. Theme is the next section. The author gives us insight into the early days of World of Darkness games. One of the founders of White Wolf tells us the purpose of the World of Darkness games was to create and tell stories with a theme. The reason for this is themes enable us to experience stories at an emotional level. Emotionally impactful storytelling was the intent of the World of Darkness games. While I don't agree good role-playing must be emotionally impactful, I do appreciate this insight into the creator's intentions, and I believe this made the World of Darkness games an innovation in the RPG space. Let me read you a quote from this section. Terry gets his quotes at the end of the episode. Here's mine. Not all education is facts and formulas. There's an education about being human beings, a right-brained learning that comes from reading literature, experiencing drama, and even storytelling. What might the technocracy say in response to this view on education? We are given four themes appropriate to mummy characters. The first is loss. Each time mummies die, they are taken from the people and things they love. Second is the meaning of life. People who live for centuries will form a different view of the purpose of their lives. Third is revenge. Mummies are part of a global struggle. Do they retain a sense of purpose or pursue grudges? Or were they drafted into someone else's grudges? Finally, megalomania. Most mummies were rulers of ancient Egypt, a kingdom that was their whole world. Do they want to reclaim such lofty power again? We are reminded of two storytelling techniques from vampire books, flashbacks, and dream sequences. Flashbacks, when expanded, become parallel stories the players can switch between. The amnesia mummies experience when they start a new life cycle can be used to justify the players not remembering how the parallel story in a past era played out. Thus, parallel stories can work. Also, the culture of ancient Egypt considered dreams important, nudging players to take dream sequences more seriously. When Bane mummies die, they go directly to the Hell of Apophis, where they suffer tortures that have unhinged their minds. Apophis is the giant serpent of ancient Egyptian culture that continually tries to devour the sun. The text states Apophis does really exist. The Bane mummies start each life with instructions from Apophis to carry out. The Bane mummies also receive instructions from Set and his followers, but Set must negotiate with Apophis for this. We are told Apophis is another name for the worm from werewolf lore, making Bane mummies enemies for vampires, mummies, and werewolves. However, judging from the stats we're given for Amam the Devourer, they should be given a lot of Egyptian magic to strengthen them before facing off with werewolves. The masquerade of the vampires enforced by the Camarilla is mirrored by the mummies. Horus enforces it strongly. Four mummy NPCs give us a sample of mummy culture. The mummy stats show them having all six virtues. I think three is enough. Amen-Kal has always been a soldier. He is a general and tactician loyal to Horus. Hedephros from the in-character fiction is next. Wife and mother of pharaohs, she regrets becoming a mummy and searches for pleasures to match her first life. She knows the spirit world well, but shares her secrets with those who can attract her interest. Horus still lives in Switzerland and has a hatred of vampires stronger than anything you've seen on social media. He commands spirits to protect him from anything the spirit world can bring against him. He still fights Set's ambitions, but sees it as a greater spiritual struggle akin to keeping the serpent from swallowing the sun. Horus has sevens and eights in all his attributes. He knows all Hekau categories at max level, and most of his backgrounds are five. His willpower is 10. His Sekhem is 99. The author wants to make it clear he's tougher than you. He's tougher than your big brother, too, so just step aside, buddy. Suhura is last, the mummy from the in-character fiction. He is thoughtful and studious and seems to be here to form bridges with other kinds of supernatural characters. We get five story seeds, two are crossovers with vampires, while three are for mummies. Since Werewolf wasn't published yet, we shouldn't be too surprised there isn't a lot of crossover material here. In the first, the followers of Set are kidnapping vampires for their blood to fuel their attempt to create more Bane mummies. Mummy and vampire players work together to foil the plan. Next, a genealogist discovers the secret of one of the mummy player characters. He threatens to reveal all unless the mummy makes him immortal, too. Third, a fellow mummy's Ba spirit contacts a player begging for help. Her body as well as potions and amulets have been stolen and must be recovered. Fourth, the players receive a package with a map to the true ruins of the Library of Alexandria and someone's heart. A Bane mummy accompanied by followers of Set will soon come for the goods. Finally, someone has been branded with a foul mark by a powerful Setite vampire. Elders of Clan Tremere want to help the poor soul. The fugitive either knows or possesses something very valuable. How much do the Tremere know? A page and a half of names from ancient Egypt comes next. Before the internet, RPG books often provided names from different times and cultures. The chapter concludes with a bibliography of six books. The first two are Egyptian Magic and Book of the Dead by E.A. Wallace Budge. I read Egyptian Magic and bits of Book of the Dead to prepare for this episode. I also read Legends of the Egyptian Gods by the same author. Budge books on Egyptology are mostly in the public domain now. That means multiple publishing companies can put them out with little expense. Budge was also a good writer and supplied lots of nice illustrations and diagrams. Many people are saying his translations of the Egyptian hieroglyphics have errors. Supplementing his books with ones by newer authors is a great idea. However, you don't need to avoid these books. After reading a few, I quite like them. I've heard Raymond Faulkner's Book of the Dead is better, a better translation, but I haven't had a chance to pick it up yet. Complete Gods and Goddesses of Ancient Egypt by Richard Wilkinson is on my buy list as well. I'll let you know if it's any good. If you want some material to beef up your World of Darkness games without spending too much, Budge's books are fine. Well, Terry, what did you think of Chapter 4?
I like that it opens up with a story of Set getting his dong cut off. That was real forward. And then we get a callback from the farmer who's like, it's actually kept everyone in my house very happy. And you're like, wait, are you? I'm not going to think through that. I like the introduction of Isis, the reinterpretation of Egyptian cosmogony, and so on. It is very vampire-centric, and it just kind of reminds me, there's a Saturday Night Live bit where it's Fisher-Price's My First Well, and it is a child looking wistfully at a large plastic well, and another child goes, I don't like it, and the lead character goes, it's not for you! Everything is for you! And whenever I see something in the World of Darkness, I immediately think that about vampires. Everything else is for you! Give him this one thing! And that is kind of the view of ancient Egypt. Bane mummies are powerful but hard to kill. It does also note that, like, not every session needs a theme. Sometimes you just want to go shopping or something like that. And I'm like, that's nice. Playtest notes. That's pretty cool. But yeah, Horus is out there and it's like, the spell of life is lost. You need Necromancy 6. If only someone who were around when it was invented were still around with Necromancy 6. So, like, I'm not sure what we're supposed to go with that yet. Six virtues. So many virtues. Yeah, it was a little bit hard to keep some of the names straight. It sets up a lot of problems with the followers of Set. Almost made me interested in any way researching or following up with what happens in Vampire. But I generally, when I do that, I get to the White Wolf Wiki and I type in, like, vamp. And I stop there and I'm like, no, I can't bring myself to do it. Too boring. And that is my relationship with the contemporary version of Vampire. Except for Beckett's Jihad Diary. Read that cover to cover. Good read. And as Adam mentioned, it's a peek into what a bunch of the early writers thought. And we get an even deeper peek in the next chapter. What's in chapter 5, Adam?
Well, chapter 5 is a story you can run called Hell's Highway. It's written specifically for an all-mummy player group. Since this is a podcast for Mage, I'm not going to cover every detail. The story is written to include extended flashbacks that become scenes that are role-played. This is intended to help mummy players flesh out their past lives. This also makes it difficult to include non-mummies. A mummy named Khonseru is asked to close down the construction of a path from one of the hells to a breach in the Earth's umbra. When this book was written, the deep, high, and low umbrae were not yet part of the World of Darkness. The players are assumed to be friends of Khonseru. All of the mummies know each other. And it's just assumed they're going to agree to help his mission after the once-per-century social gathering that mummies like to have. Scene 1 is meeting Khonseru and starting a road trip in his car. A short but very interesting section gives advice to the storyteller on handling this scene. The author suggests using folding chairs to simulate the inside of a car. The storyteller is encouraged to take the part of Khonseru and encourage the players to hop in. Casually switching back and forth from live-action role-playing, LARP or LARPing, to regular role-playing at the table appears to have been a common thing for Stephen Wick. It appears he used LARP play often for his playtesting on many World of Darkness books. This section assumes the storyteller will have no inhibitions about portraying any sort of personality for NPCs. It states the storyteller should help players adjust to LARPing with props and by setting an example. Another thing I noticed is how the story starts out with lighthearted fun. It gets more serious in the second half, but many people have the notion World of Darkness games are supposed to be serious throughout. Scene 2 has the players continuing the drive with flashback scenes interwoven. One example flashback is given with three scenes of its own. During the French Revolution, the players answered a fellow mummy's call for help to recover and preserve his body. Scene 3 returns to the problem of the demon building a path from its realm to Earth. That path appears as an exit leading off the highway the players are traveling on. Khonseru uses an amulet to transfer the players and the car they're in to the penumbra, what is called the spirit world here. The demon has used its influence to cause normal people to lose control and commit violence against each other along this part of the highway for weeks to bring the area closer to hell's influence. Once they take the exit, the players will see a road under construction. The newly paved road has an evil aura. Doesn't asphalt have that anyways? But the construction workers are ghosts of people killed in the recent violence. A toll booth soon appears manned by a minor demon, but it doesn't want to fight. It wears a uniform and wants the toll paid. The toll must be paid in conscience, honor, and love. One vampire virtue and two mummy virtues. A player should volunteer for each virtue test. They're sent into a vision where they face a challenge alone. They play out a short scene and then make a decision. The concern here is if one of the tests is failed, the story can't proceed. The player is told which virtue is being tested, and in the vision, there's a temptation to avoid displaying that virtue. If the player makes the wrong choice in the vision, no roll is needed. He fails. If the player makes the right choice, they roll against their virtue. If they make the wrong decision or fail, they lose a point in that virtue, but the toll is paid. Botching isn't mentioned, but should be impossible. Whatever happens, the story proceeds, but failure has a penalty. I like this system for scenes in the Umbra for Mage. When trying to leave a realm, a mage could roll against willpower, a background, or an attribute. If they fail, they can still leave, but they lose a point. If it's the climax of a story, the loss could be permanent, otherwise restore it after a game session or two. I was surprised by how mature and clever these three tests are. Even though the player is told which virtue is being tested after playing through a scene, it's easy to forget and focus on being virtuous in general. If a player tries to help each NPC they encounter, they may fail. They have to keep track of what is being tested and not lose sight of the big picture. You may want to use these tests in your own stories. Scene 4 has the players encountering a road work crew supervised by minor demons. They can't drive around and should realize this is where the road's construction can be blocked. If they interfere with anything, the main demon soon arrives. He looks imposing, but if the players don't attack, he'll challenge them to a naming contest. This is connected to the Hekaw path of mummy magic, which is all about the true names of things like wolves, sand, etc. It is reminiscent of the scene at the end of the first Sandman book where the Lord of Dreams has a battle of words with a demon in hell. Suggestions for dice systems are given. If the players win, the demons leave and the prisoners can be freed to the true afterlife. If they lose, they will be in chains and forced to help the road construction. They either plan a prison break or get released when the road is finished. Well, that's a sample story. Terry, what did you think?
That was a sample story. Woo! But it is an interesting way to run things. As you mentioned, it depends on you and your group being very comfortable acting and embodying different characters, and it gives you role-playing notes on the character that you're following. There's like no upside to the story. Like it's either like everything turns out okay, or you wind up joining a like hellish work crew until you stage a prison break. So you don't get anything. There's no thank you. At best, you get to stop at a roadside attraction and buy zingers, which was a type of hostess snack cake I was unfamiliar with. And I find it interesting that that is the one that is listed as trademarked. All the other ones are just kind of genericized. It was weird coming from Mage to be like, no, these are the virtues. This is how you use it. This is the right answer. And I'm like, That's not how a Euthanatoi would view that. So that kind of put my cards on the table there. And it made me realize I've never really spent much time on I-40 from the Carolinas to California. I've done I-10 and I-30 as well as I-80, but never I-40. So that went back on my life highway list. It's interesting the way spirits are presented. Like the only statistic we get about them is willpower. And it's like, I don't know what else you want. It's like, oh, okay. And recommends that you pit someone's karba against the willpower of the demon. That's kind of how you resolve it. That was interesting. It goes into some grisly information about the killings of the people who are working the highway, and you're like, oh, this is the world of darkness. Sometimes mortals are just kind of boned out of nowhere. I'm trying to figure out how I would run this. Like, I almost feel like if I ran it, I would tell the group, so there's this batshit quest that's in the back of the 1E mummy book who wants to set up some folding chairs with me, and then kind of go from there. And if the answer is yes, we do it. If the answer is just the audible noise of every player at my table blinking like I've gone mad, that would also be an acceptable reply from my table, and we would continue to do the weird little games that I like to run that usually involve things getting more and more complicated until resolution occurs. So yeah, That was chapter five. Would you run this game, Adam? Would you run that quest, the Highway 666?
This story, more or less as written, I would only run it for an all mummy player group. If I had any player character in there that was not a mummy, then not this story. However, the three tests given, sort of, I don't know, what vision quest tests from scene three, I would lift those out and use those in like the High Umbra in Mage. I would be fine with that. I think it would be interesting. And I like this mechanic, how you don't want to fail, but if you do, you know, the story can keep moving forward. It's not like, oh, well, go home and let's find a new story. So I thought that was well thought out.
Got it. Would you set up the folding chairs and just befuddle completely your family? What's Dad doing? Daddy's playing his game.
Before reading this book, I probably would have said no. But now after reading this book, it's like, well, I'm kind of tempted.
Yeah.
I'm kind of curious how that would turn out. I mean, yeah, I'd probably have egg on my face afterwards, but the experience would be interesting enough. I just might do it.
The experience would be interesting enough. You're like, yeah, if we ever did that, I would gladly spend the money to create like a little jacket patch. Where it's like, I tangled with my Bon Con, all I got was this lousy backpack patch or something like that. I don't know. I'm not very good with marketing, graphing, or design.
I took the drive in the folding
chairs.
Yeah,
there we go.
And you see, the people who know, they know.
Yeah, once you know, you know. But yeah, that was a story. It's a style. And it's also one of those things where you're like kind of working backwards and you're like, oh, this was, the author was like in their mid-20s. This is better than I would be able to do.
Yeah.
At the time, that's good. And but yeah, those are my thoughts on chapter five.
Well, I'm ready to talk about the book as a whole. General thoughts. I've got a few things to share, but Terry, I'd like to hear yours.
This was written by someone who it didn't feel like they had fully formed this into a role-playing game book, and it was written in such a way that you kind of already had to know what you're doing before you could use it. And I feel like that is one of the major changes that has occurred in game books over time, where books have gotten better at presuming a level of understanding of their audience, either from, I have no idea what a role-playing game is, to, I'm not even going to bother describing what a role-playing game is, because if you've picked up this book, you clearly already know what it is. So this is geared towards someone who is a little bit more theatrical, that is already familiar with another game, which makes sense, because you have to have vampire or something to even be able to do it. It doesn't go over a lot of the core systems. The magic is slow, but you got centuries. In a more contemporary telling, I think I would want to spend a lot more time in the storytelling chapter to be like, what is it like running a game across centuries and dipping in and out of time, and how do you keep track of that? And I think that is a question that was addressed both in terms of Mummy the Resurrection, to be like, hey, how do we have a faster resurrection cycle? In Mummy the Resurrection, one of your stats is basically your ability to tell the judges of Ma'at, yeah, I really learned my lesson, let me go try again. And then you have Mummy the Curse, which is much more about hopping around in time and kind of recovering your memory at the cost of power. And Mummy the Curse being one of the rare games where you start at your most powerful and your utterances are absolutely devastating, but you don't remember anything. And it is interesting what themes different groups try and take from Mummy. You get a lot of hints about what could come. Again, it's very vampire centric. The magic system is kind of interesting. It has a bunch of neat little moving parts to it. I'm not sure how it would work in an actual game, because it is weird to compare, like, how do we come up with the plot line where it is useful for me to do a minor weather adjustment, even though narratively that could be quite useful and important, especially in a game where you're like, yeah, your goal is to keep these crops going. Like, you're the mummy that protects this area. And it makes me wonder, like, kind of what the minimum viable version of Mage would be. Like, if Mage had only been released as an add-on to Vampire, would you be able to do it in the same 45,000 words that this book used? And I find that to be a useful thought exercise. It wouldn't be nearly as broad, but could you summarize and put together the spheres in the same number of pages? Probably. It would be real rough. It would be kind of doable. It's always fun to see mages referred to as magi and everything being capitalized, whether it be lupine or fairy or ghost with a capital G. The background information was kind of interesting, but like, there is a certain romance I have with that kind of vague world And I wonder if I would have, at current, the storytelling chops to pull it off compared to the other games I have, where I have an entire Chronicle book at my disposal, or there's a bunch of pre-gen campaigns and Chronicles I can do, or alternatively, the setting is sufficiently defined that it's easy enough for me to knit pieces together. But thinking back to a time when the World of Darkness was, I'm not going to say empty, but still ill-defined, and I don't know if that's a place I can ever go back to, but it's fun taking a glimpse of a text that comes out of that era. Pretty good writing. It was a person who knew how to put words next to each other, and I appreciated that. Again, it's always interesting to read books that essentially have one author, because you're pretty confident that the vision is of a piece and unitary. What did you think of it, Adam?
Oh, yeah, I had a number of thoughts here. Starting off, I was skimming around online a while back, and someone said, yeah, you know, the first Mummy book was a vampire supplement. And I was thinking to myself, yeah, okay, it was a vampire supplement. But although it does have the green marble appearance on the cover that the vampire books had, it has its own logo at the bottom of the front cover. It says A World of Darkness with these, you know, stylized letters in front of a globe. And so it says sourcebook for the storytelling system, including Vampire the Masquerade. So early on, the people at White Wolf had this notion that they were going to have five games. Vampire was one of them, and they were also going to have other bits that sort of fit between the cracks of the five games, and those were going to go under the heading of A World of Darkness. So Mummy was, I can't remember if it was the first, but it was one of the first A World of Darkness books, so it wasn't actually a vampire supplement. I thought this book was great. I approach it in the way that I approach first two Mage rule books. When I sit down at the table to run Mage, I have the second edition rule book on the table, and I'm referencing things when I need from there. But my game is informed by what I remember from reading in the first edition rule book. And it's the same for me with Mummy. When I want to use mummies as NPCs or get a rare mummy player, then I will have the second edition mummy book at my table. But I will be keeping in mind things that I read in the first mummy book. For me, it was that good. Stephen Wick, was a great writer. I think the in-character fiction that started off the first four chapters was very well done. It was enjoyable. It was interesting. It did a good job of getting the concepts across. There was very great economy. I mean, he said in one sentence what later writers would take a paragraph to say. He knew what he was doing, and he did it well. Also, role-playing fan level, I think I share his approach to role-playing games. His comfort for rules complexity and a light, open-handed approach to handling them is more in line with me. So when I read like the first Mummy book, I think of it as, hey, I could take this book and run it and run a game. I don't see it so much. I've talked to a lot of other Mage fans online on our Discord server. So you can have some great conversations there, by the way. We'll supply a link for you. But a lot of Mage fans are like, oh, that's a relic from the early days. It's interesting from a historical perspective, but I'm not going to use that in my games. It's like, okay, well, your table is your table, but I could pick this book up and use it in a game, and I think I would enjoy it. Lots of good shadow history here. The secret history of what the supernaturals were doing that mortals, you know, regular people don't even suspect. This book had lots of it. It was great to read. Loved it. This book repeatedly mentions running parallel games in ancient Egypt, but with an 83 pages, it just can't support that. And so I understand. I mean, at the same time, I think that's really too bad. It says multiple times, hey, parallel games in ancient Egypt, wouldn't that be fun? It's like, yeah, it might be, but I don't know ancient Egypt too well, and you're not giving me that many tools to do it. I need more than a list of people's names mixed in with place and object names, and you're not telling me which is which. One question I had is, should the four children of Horus be brought into the World of Darkness? There were four sons. Each one represented a direction on the compass. There was Mesta, who had a human head, Hapi, who had a dog head, Tuamotef, who had a jackal head, and Kebsenef, that had a hawk head. That might be interesting. They factor into the Egyptian Book of the Dead. Maybe they could play a role in the World of Darkness. I think the Order of Hermes really are the inheritors of Egyptian magic. Not exactly the trappings and toys and the style, but certainly the paradigm, the underlying beliefs about the world they live in, how magic works, how you make things happen with magic. Got the words of power with proper pronunciation and tone of voice. You have the carefully worded contracts with spirits, the idea that all supernatural beings, even gods, can be commanded if you know how, and also the focus on the importance of true names. It made sense to me how multiple times in this book they draw a parallel between Hermetic magic and ancient Egyptian magic. It's like, yeah, after reading Egyptian magic by E.A. Wallace Budge and this book, I really see it. I think mummies would, if they got to know any Hermetics in the modern era, or later eras, I should say, I think they would see them as the inheritors of Egyptian magic. You've mixed in some weird stuff, you've got a few things wrong, but you're playing in our ballpark. I think mummies are more similar to mages in general than other supernatural character options in the world of darkness. I think that all mummies have a one dot in necromancy, so even if they don't spend any more dots in Hekka, which most players will, mummies sort of think of themselves as having some ability with magic, and so calling themselves wizards, magicians, sorcerers, etc. is not that far-fetched. And when they see other mages, I think they would recognize something in common that they would not share with were-creatures or vampires, changelings, etc. And I think this book was written specifically so that mummies would be well-positioned to mix with the other World of Darkness player types in general. Mummies are not going to be so afraid or offended necessarily by vampires. Their blood has no nutritional value to vampires. So vampires who have know anything about mummies are not going to attack them for blood. They have a connection with, in the spirit realm, some of the things that werewolves are supposed to care about. They've traveled through the lands of the dead, so they can talk to wraiths. As for changelings, well, the mists are going to make them forget changelings anyway, so who cares? But I think the author of this book really wanted mummies to mix in with any other sort of game that may come along in the future. I think in the World of Darkness, when Isis and Anubis created the Spell of Life, it was either epic-level paradigm engineering, and what I mean by that is taking a set of cultural beliefs and making them a real thing in the world, or it was a discovery of a fundamental level of the tapestry, you know, the universe of the universe of the World of Darkness, not the real world. So the creation of the Spell of Life in ancient Egypt was a real big deal, and I think that for those storytellers who want to play with this in their games, I think there might be something for mages in the modern era to really notice and discuss if they come across a mummy that can actually talk to them about that. Would the Spell of Life work today in the modern era? Depends on the storyteller's point of view. Some people would say the consensus makes that impossible. Others would say, hey, I'd really like to have that in my game, so I'd like to make it possible. The World of Darkness books tend to hint that it is possible, but again, I think that's up to the storyteller. I would make mummies good at protecting their own personal selves from sphere magic with their amulets, but I would make mummies very weak at counter magic that was not protecting their own bodies or their own spirits. So I think if some mage was going to do a spell that would hurt a whole bunch of people in a room, I think the mummy would be very weak at countering that. But if the mage is going to attack one mummy directly, then the mummy could protect pretty well. Mummies always need special ingredients for their magic, so that slows them down, but their magic is strong enough to get mages' attention. So I think if mages did encounter mummies, they would usually have motivation to get to know them better. I would allow mummy player characters in most of my games, and I think the fact that mummies know other mummies is a sort of built-in contacts background that has real value and could be an asset to a mage player group that wanted to bring them in. One idea of ancient Egyptian culture was a person's fate is decided before they are born, and nothing can change it. So the question in my mind is, how do mummies consider that? Is that attached to their first life, and after that it becomes flexible and who knows what's going to happen? Or do they think that their entire existence is decided by fate, in which case they would spend a lot of their time and attention trying to properly determine their fate, because that would tell them like everything for the centuries that are yet to come. So I think that's a good question for storytellers to ponder. I'm not going to give the answer for that. Last, I just want to touch on something. The original Euthanatos from the first edition rulebook, they had this notion that death and life was a recurring cycle with reincarnation, and a person who could get a mastery of that would have the true power over their own destiny and their own existence. And that was like a goal of the whole tradition before they got a rewrite later on. So I just have to wonder, if you had original Euthanatos in your games, would they be obsessed with tracking down mummies and getting to know them? Would the mummies like put out a notice to each other, hey, Euthanatos, these guys are like seriously scary. Don't mix with them. Don't make a friend with one of these guys. They want to steal our secrets and use them for like way weird stuff. So just stay away. Interesting thing to play with if you use original Euthanatos. But that wraps up my thoughts. Hopefully I didn't have too many for our listeners, but I really did enjoy this game. It really did get me thinking. I have some story ideas. Before I launch into it, Terry, was there a quote that just leaped off the page for you?
I did. Well, one thing you mentioned was the Euthanatoi view of mummies, and we have the line in their 2E tradition book of, are mummies stuck on the wheel, or do they ride it like experts? The Euthanatoi aren't sure. That's the 2E version of it, but that was a line that always stuck out
for me. Oh, I'd forgotten that. Yeah.
Yeah. There are two lines in here, one that makes me think mummy, one that makes me think World of Darkness. The mummy one is, once during our trek, I stopped to point out a shooting star blazing in the heavens above. Ra does battle with Apophis, so the sun may rise tomorrow, he explained. I thought it was a meteorite. It's that too, he said. And I thought that was a good mummy view of things. And then the World of Darkness intro, where you're like, is this the World of Darkness? Yes. It was a little after midnight. I remember the time precisely. I had just returned one of my girls, Julie, to her parents' house, and her father had been quick to point out the 8-minute discrepancy between his watch and Julie's midnight curfew. I told him that if Julie would learn to dress faster, I could have gotten her home on time. Like I said, I was something of a scoundrel in my mortal years. I ran away from the old man while he began a tantrum that must have ended in a coronary. You're like, sexy vampires. Also, said Nick. And those are the ones that stuck out to me.
Definitely. Yeah, I remember those now. Those were great ones. Well, I just had three story ideas that I just had to share. Number one, whether a player or an NPC, a mummy allows the players a rare opportunity to use his memories as a bridge to ancient Egypt. The mummy wants to regain memories of his past life, but the players can learn much about ancient magic. Using a talisman with the Mind 3 Time 2 effect, the players cast their minds back in time. However, an unknown power of the talisman is awakened, forcing the players to spend every other day in borrowed bodies in ancient Egypt. They look like locals and have no trouble with the language. The mummy can help them to blend in. In the past, they must find the talisman to align it with its current incarnation. In the present, they must protect their bodies for the days they are unconscious. The mummy didn't realize the talisman that sent the players to the past was provided by the mummy's enemy, an enemy that plans to strike soon. Number two, the weight of centuries can trouble the mind. Mummies allow their fellows a lifetime of depression or reflection, but after that, they intervene. Sokaris is talented in magic, and he's needed in Horus's struggle. Two mummies approach the characters with a letter of recommendation from a trusted mentor. The players are asked to take Sokaris to the Shining City in the High Umbra, something the mummies cannot do, in order to restore his sense of purpose. The Council of Nine wants updated directions to this realm. Gaining new allies and permission to copy ancient scrolls sweetens the deal. The players will have to find the Shining City based on directions centuries out of date, in an area full of dreams of cities and fortresses that are known to protect themselves. The fact that Sokaris only agreed to go because he was told he'd find the spirit of his wife from his last life doesn't make matters easier. Number three, the players confront an intruder near a node in their city. She turns out to be a strong sorceress, but her magic baffles them. She begs for help protecting several nodes in the area. Although she doesn't reveal her secrets right away, this mummy is one of a group that have come to the city to prevent the followers of Set from poisoning the nodes for a ritual of the followers of Set. When the players learn two nodes are held by vampires, they begin to trust the mysterious visitors. Most vampires are ignorant of magic, but the followers of Set are cognizant of mystic secrets. Their blood sorcery, together with the strange discipline of Serpentis, makes them a formidable threat. Their tactic of using other vampires as unsuspecting decoys makes the followers hard to deal with. Can the players learn how to track and identify the followers before they seize more nodes? The more they hold, the stronger their blood sorcery becomes. The mummies are willing to aid the mages, but they are offended by the oddest things. Lightning raids and secrets of old Egypt will keep the players' nights interesting. This is my reply to the storytelling chapter, which said, hey, you might mix vampires with mummies, but yeah, we're done now. So it's like, yeah, we'll take that. So those are my thoughts. Terry, any closing thoughts before we wrap up?
It was wonderful reading a short book again. And I am excited to see how the 2E changes it immediately on its heels in such a way that we could compare them back to back. But I'm also wondering what we get for those additional 60 pages.
I hope it's worth it, but we are going to find out.
Yeah.
I did read second edition book, but it's kind of been a while, so I'm going to enjoy the refresher. Well, if you have something to say, please contact us at magethepodcast@gmail.com with your questions, comments, or feedback. Subscribe to Mage the Podcast on iTunes, Google Play, TuneIn, and other aggregators. If you like the show, others might like it too. And if you leave a review of us, it makes us more visible in their searches. You can follow us on Twitter at Mage the Podcast. We're also on the web at magethepodcast.com. You can listen to past episodes there and see the complete show notes. We have a YouTube channel now where you can find our episodes. There's a link in the show notes, but just take a search for Mage the Podcast. You're probably going to find us. We're also on Mastodon. The link is in the show notes. This episode was assisted greatly by our executive producers. Terry, can you share their names?
I would be glad to. I would like to thank Oracle Sean Gallagher, Oracle Ben Bendelow, Oracle Buck Gregory, Oracle Christopher Phillips, Oracle Guy Stewart, Oracle Josh Hillerup, Oracle Pukaji, Oracle Jay Widener, Oracle McHale, Oracle the Crew of Erebus, Archmaster Andrew Adelstein, Archmaster Brad of the Blue, Archmaster Bubba the Pale One, Archmaster Dan Svensson, Archmaster Derek Semsek, Archmaster Jason Vines, Archmaster Morgan Aran, and Archmaster Nathan Weaver, along with Alex, Alexia, Anders S., Anon, Bedurfi, Berto, Blaise Hibbert, Blake Ryan, Brandon, Bryce Perry, Chris Blake, Sinchotis, Daniel Cuppen, Daniel Scribner, Darren Hennessy, David Roy, Dennis Osborne, Eli Levenger, Eric Schwenk, Frager Rock, George Laura, Henry Kraft, Ia Bull, Jason Kennedy, Jason W. Briggs, Jay Gatsby, Jeff Brin, Jenna F., John Magnuson, Jolyn Andes, Lawson Stuff, Joshua Heath, Kathleen Halperin, Chris Kinner, Leroy Bryce, Leslie Weatherstone, Matthew Proyle, Michael Creedle, Michael Parker, Nathan Weaver, Nibero, Neil Patterson, Nikita Klamenov, Oliver Schindler, Patrick McNamara, Patrick Mulder, Rachel Grace, Richard Bat Brewster, Robart the Robot, Ryan Stray, Rob H., Ryan Kennedy, Samuel Tobin, Starfish, Stephen Carton, Thrice Great, Vincent Hamilton, Walter, William Connolly, and William Martin. Thank you so much for your support.
Yes, a big thank you from me as well. If you would like to become an executive producer for Mage the Podcast, it would help us keep producing episodes like this one. You would also become a part of our own council to discuss upcoming projects. The link in the show notes will get you started. Well, thanks everyone for listening. Until next time, truth until paradox, baby.
And if you're going to pick an eternal enemy, make sure that they're not just phoning it in. And when they say eternal, they mean kind of for a while. We want actual effing eternal here. We're mages, darn it. Go change reality. Bye.